per-seat on-demand jet service. Sounds like a big idea. How's it working out? I'm Paul Plack, and this is Aero News. Welcome into this Aero News special feature, and thanks for downloading us today. My guest is Ed Akabuchi, who is the president and CEO of Dayjet Corporation. Dayjet launched just over 3 weeks ago with a small fleet, which will grow, of Eclipse 500 very light jets, serving several destinations in Florida and will be expanding throughout the Southeast in the next couple of years, according to the business plan. Ed, thanks for taking a few minutes out of what I know is a crazy month to join us and talk to our listeners today.
Oh, thank you, Paul. My pleasure.
Let me start by asking you how the launch went, just as an overall had time to wipe the forehead off and sit down and take a deep breath stage. How are things going after 3 weeks?
Well, the launch was pretty interesting. We had a pretty significant turnout at all the locations. We had an event at each of our major Dayport locations for the local communities, businesses, members, and so forth. And that turned out to be pretty exciting. Got to meet a number of the people that I've just been seeing in names and reports and so forth. Good to match names and faces. Since then, we've been ratcheting up slowly. As you know, our plan has always been to take it a step at a time to make sure that at each level our systems are doing what they're supposed to do. Had a few surprises here and there, things that we didn't realize how they were going to operate, mostly internally, mostly around the dynamic nature of the system. There's so much more dynamicism that goes on in terms of changes of flights and what airplane and tail number somebody might or might not fly on, and how that gets communicated to customers through our customer care systems has been taking a lot of focus on. That seems like an odd tidbit, but it turns out to be a very important element to keep everybody informed and yet only provide the data when it's not while it's still fluid, but as it starts firming up. So there's some tricks we've had to learn there. As far as the response goes, it's been increasing significantly from week to week. We're tracking a number of metrics. I don't think we have enough data yet that I feel comfortable with some of the trends. We're still, the trends are positive. They are not below our lowest expectation, nor are they above our highest. We had a range, and we're pretty comfortably snuggled in the middle somewhere. We're looking at some things that perhaps getting less response than we anticipated, and trying to take some corrections there in terms of markets, pricing, value, and so forth. And then we're looking at some things that are getting a better response that we anticipated, and taking a look at what contributes to that success and seeing how we can replicate it.
Well, now, you mentioned that the operational side of it and some of the unique challenges there seemed an odd tidbit to mention, unquote, but they're really not. There are two stories here. I think there's been quite a bit of coverage given to the aviation story side of Dayjet, but very little given to the operational side, and I want to get into that in the second half of the interview. Let me ask you first about Dayports, because you've opened with Tallahassee, Gainesville, Boca Raton, Lakeland, and Pensacola in Florida, so five locations. You want to be in dozens more in the next couple of years. Tell us, first of all, what qualifies an airport to be a dayport? What minimum amenities do you need there? Does it have to have rental cars or a restaurant, or what needs to be there?
Yeah, in fact, all our dayports, or day stops for that matter, places where we go with a full plane, traditional, somewhat like a one-way charter, only it's more simplified. Any of those places have to be pre-authorized, certified, and they have to have minimum amenities such as car facilities, taxi, fuel, night lights, paved runways, a pleasant, comfortable FBO setting, plus a relationship with the folks on the ground so that we know that we can pick up the phone and call if we have to send an aircraft there for a customer.
Now, those things all make sense, because I assumed if people are going to replace automobile travel with light jet travel, which is your goal, that they'd have to have those things available when they get there. What about the wider community of folks on the ground? What about the communities in which these airports are located? Have you found any resistance among the what we like to call the NIMBYs, or the people who don't want any jets coming? And how are they receiving jets and specifically the Eclipse 500?
Sure. Well, first of all, I was just talking about general requirements for day ports or day stops. If you get into a day port situation where we have people and we have a relationship with a community, we do quite a bit more, including doing work with a local chamber of commerce, with a Better Business Bureau, with local community companies in the area, the political leadership and so forth. So we become actually part of the community. We don't just hang a shingle and say we're going to fly here. We hire employees, we buy fuel, and we make a positive contribution to the community. That's for day ports. And now, one of the things you mentioned there, it's interesting, is that we wondered what the actual response was going to be as we geared up in terms of the communities, and been very pleasantly surprised to find that, in fact, quite the contrary. Instead of finding the communities don't want us to come, there are communities that are lining up that want the service, simply because the connectivity it affords at the price points that we can deliver are something that a lot of these communities are seeking. And on the plus side of the ledger, the aircraft is quiet, it's clean, it's fairly unobtrusive. In fact, it's extremely unobtrusive in the community as it compares to other jets, and it even compares favorably to turboprop and piston aircraft in terms of noise footprint and so forth. In fact, one of the communities that we launched in is notorious about maintaining strict guidelines on noise. That's Boca Raton, and we've had a tremendous response in Boca Raton. The airport commission, the local community, everyone is very pleased with the service that we're offering, because it does enhance connectivity and it doesn't add to the noise pollution.
Now, when I looked at that list of five cities the first time, I have to admit I kind of shook my head, and then I cocked it sideways and wondered, what is it about these cities that make these an appropriate place to launch? But I see, when I look a little deeper, I see the state capital. I see two big university cities, and
correct,
I see at least a couple of places where either the demographics of the population or the industrial profile looks like a good match for this. How many? I assume that what you really need to do is stay out of places like Birmingham, Atlanta, Orlando, and stay out of the mix with big commercial air traffic.
Well, of course, that's part of the whole equation here. We don't just give that lip service. We don't just say we're going to fly to small cities and then turn around and fly to large ones. We are very committed as a company into what we are. We know exactly what we are, and we know exactly what we're not. We can bring value if we find pockets of or significant population centers that don't have enough critical mass to ever substantiate any form of regular scheduled service, yet are growing communities that have perhaps a disproportionate amount of travel needs that are being unmet. And all the communities that we launched in fit that criteria very, very nicely. Now, the interesting thing is that there's many, many, many communities like that. We don't even have to even think about going into larger, what you might consider traditional Class B airspace airports, simply because there's plenty of demand getting people around the edges, if you would. So the other factor, of course, is that if we travel if we fly between the locations that we're flying, we have essentially a wide open palette in terms of a clear palette in terms of other air traffic and congestion. We've found that we've had practically no en route delays. We've had some weather. The speed of the aircraft being a jet allows us to accommodate for weather conditions by flying around the weather. We're looking forward to some of the enhancements that Eclipse has in the near future in terms of the avionics suite, more tools on board to help our crews navigate the weather situations better. But we found thus far it's been very, very appropriate. No many delays and a lot of people that are interested. So it's got all the right elements for a very successful story.
We're talking with Ed Akabuchi, who is the president and CEO of DayJet Corporation. We'll be back to talk more in a moment. I'm Paul Plack. You're listening to a special feature from Aero News.
Diamond's DA-42 Twin Star is General Aviation's ultimate flying machine. Fly fast with the confidence of a twin for the cost of a single. Go direct over water or rugged terrain and cover great distances in the first and only piston aircraft with an advanced airframe, avionics, and engines. The DA-42 gives you options you've never had before, including the Garmin G1000 and known ice protection. Go where you want, when you want, fast and for less. Visit Diamond on the web at www.diamondair.com or call 888-359-3220.
Finally, aviation headsets have evolved. Clarity Aloft is the next generation of headset design for a number of reasons. Clarity Aloft headsets are known for the superior clarity of sound. They're lightweight but rugged enough to meet military specifications. Best of all, they boast better noise reduction than ANR in the speech frequencies that matter most to you. For more information, call 612-747-3197 or check out the innovative Clarity Aloft headset on the web at clarityaloft.com.
Welcome back to this Aero News special feature. I'm Paul Platt, talking today with Ed Akabuchi, who is the president and CEO of DayJet Corporation. DayJet officially launched service a little over 3 weeks ago, and we're just kind of talking about how it went. Ed, we've talked quite a bit about the aviation side of this, but an equally fascinating story that I think would be of interest to our listeners is the IT side of this story. And you are very, very unique in this. And let me just kind of set it up and you tell me if I've got the basic backdrop pictured correctly. You did work for a long time for IBM. You were a co-founder of Citrix Systems. And DayJet is a seeming non sequitur on your resume, but not really, because what you have really set out to do is solve what math professors call the traveling salesman problem. And in essence, this has become a huge software undertaking that just happens to involve airplanes.
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it. I'd want to qualify one thing. I wouldn't pretend that we set out to actually solve the traveling salesman problem, because as any math aficionado will tell you, is that it's an unsolvable problem. What we've set out to do is, within reasonable time, find optimal solutions which meet our customers' requirements in highly complex environments for which you can't find a finite solution. There isn't enough computers in the universe to solve the problems. So what you have to do is develop what mathematicians call heuristics, and heuristics that are aided by traditional optimization techniques to make the most efficient use of the time that you're waiting for the yes or no answer, to find a way to construct a trip segment that satisfies your needs and doesn't break anybody else's. And that turns out to be a very complicated problem, as the number of segments, travelers, and cities and vehicles increases. So it does indeed become fundamentally a very serious leading edge mathematics problem. We've been able to do a lot of work ourselves. We've done some collaborative work with universities, with specifically Georgia Tech. We've done some work with MIT, Virginia Tech. And one of the things that's been very rewarding about this whole thing is that it's actually fostered an entire area of study, real-time optimization, which is getting a lot of focus in the operations research world, and in fact has even gotten some federal grants for different universities to study some of the problems that are spinoffs out of the work that we've done. So I feel pretty good about the accomplishments of the team, but of course in the final analysis none of that is relevant if we can't deliver a good service, good quality value, in a model that people understand and accept. And that's really the big piece of the work, is making it all real. You know, the math and the science was done years ago, And we've been working for the last year or so, 2 years, in turning it into a real interactive operation. And we're getting some very nice results out of that part.
I guess I should define a traveling salesman math problem for listeners who may not know what it is. Ron Schreck comes to mind. He's a pilot in North Carolina who built an RV-8 experimental and decided he got this wild hair that on the 4th of July he was going to try to at least touch the wheels down at every public use airport in the state of North Carolina within one day. And he actually ended up enlisting the aid of a university mathematics department to try to develop a route. And what it comes down to is if a traveling salesman has to visit the most stops possible within a period of time, he has to find the most efficient route. And once you get past a handful of locations to visit, the math problem turns into just an enormous complex problem that even supercomputers can't tackle.
It's simple problems that degenerate into very complex, and you know where the solution set is much bigger than we can even imagine. And the original formulation of the traveling salesman problem was very simple. It was only 50 cities, different costs going between them, and what's the cheapest way to visit all 50 cities?
Right, and that includes.
We still don't have a solution for it.
I was going to say, and at some level, that solution involves, when you say cheapest, involves the value of time as well.
Right. Whatever the cost is from going from city to city, it's a simple question: how can I visit all 50 cities for the lowest cost? If it costs me X to go between one city pair and another, and Y another. Mm-hmm. And then, which is kind of the it's not what we do exactly, but it's the essence of the complexity of what we do.
Well,
you can imagine that's just one airplane.
Well, sure.
One car.
You guys set out to start out with 1,500 people, or at least make it available on the first day to 1,500 people. And I guess 600 actually took you up on that offer. Now, that already makes an enormously complex computer model. But really, DayJet as a concept works better the more people use it. It smooths things out.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, this is a model that doesn't work with. I mean, it works better theoretically. I mean, not practically. You have to work out all the operations issues, right? But in theory, the larger the number, the better. So a 500 airplane network works much better than a 10, 15, 20 airplane network. And with the numbers that we're accustomed to seeing in normal manual charter operations of 3, 4, 5, 6 airplanes, that's not even in the same plateau as the efficiencies you can gain as you get bigger. Of course, the complexity explodes as you grow too. We started out with about 1,500 slots that were allocated to about 200 and some odd companies. And since we announced, we're about 200 and almost 290 companies signed on, about almost 2,000 slots that have been allocated. And out of those, about 1,000 have actually been through the whole process of registration, credit check, credit cards, and so forth. And about half of them have done quotes, and about a quarter of the ones that have done quotes have bought trips. So we're getting a pretty good uptake, in fact, higher than we expected at this stage. We're doing some things to try to improve the yield of all that, and you know, by adjusting time windows and things like that.
Now, you predicted in your model that 80% of your revenue would come from travelers who would park their cars and get on a plane, not from people who would otherwise be traveling airlines. Do you have a feel for whether that has worked out to be about right?
No, it didn't. As it turns out, it's more like 100% of our travelers.
Really?
Our drivers. In fact, that's one of the things that we're working on. It's pretty interesting. As you know, we have two different models. We have per seat model and per plane. Per plane is a little bit, it's pretty similar to charter, except simplified without some of the concierge services, without, you know, a lot of the value added services, just stop and go and drop. But it is fundamentally a whole plane charter, and you have to charter the airplane and you pay something that's much higher in terms of cost per mile. And what we found is that of all the customers that we signed up, we've had about a quarter of the quotes, and we're over 5,000 quotes already, but over a quarter of the quotes that we've seen have been relative to full plane, but very, very, very few takers. In fact, the other side of the equation, the per seat, the aggregated services are really doing much better than we thought they were going to do at this stage. And that's very encouraging. So we're doing looking at some things to enhance the product in the per seat side. And over the next few months, I think you're going to see some exciting new developments, which we've had under development for a while, but we'll just be bringing them to the market sooner.
I lived in Florida for about 6 years, and Florida is one of those states like Texas or Ohio, if you're driving north to south, where if you're in a car, it's deceivingly small on the map. If you actually get to Florida and have to go somewhere, I know, it's kind of funny to hear somebody driving down from Georgia, for example, cross the state line and stop for lunch and say, "Oh, look, hon, we're in Florida. I want to see the sunset in Key West tonight." And
right.
Sorry, you can't get there. It takes forever
That's
to get through
day.
Florida. Yeah, exactly. And so I guess if for anyone who does have to get around Florida, this is going to be an incredible boon if they were otherwise taking a car. How do you think this is going to work in terms of expansion?
Well, there's been a little bit of a misconception that we're a Florida-only service. We launched with our five initial day ports in Florida, but the service region itself extends into southern Alabama and southern Georgia, as far north as Savannah today. It's kind of about 125-mile loop around the northern border of Florida. The reason we do that is we want to keep the aircraft within, so that they're recoverable by the model and by the dispatching system. As we add more day ports farther north, that border will continue to expand, so the full plane services will be available to more people. So we've actually been getting a lot of quotes and been collecting a lot of data about where people want to go. That's a byproduct of the quoting system. I get on a daily basis a ranked ordered report of different locations, day port, day stops that people want to investigate further, and it's given us a pretty good sense of where the customers want us to go next.
Well, you must be
And there, a lot of them are outside of Florida.
You must be making Vern Rayburn a happy guy. Are you going to be able to hire enough pilots and other people to keep the model expanding at the rate that the market wants it?
Well, we're gonna let me answer that question kind of in a backwards way. We're going to be expanding our service so that we can always provide a safe and reliable and a high quality service. And we'll limit our expansion by our ability to limit to grow the operations. So we've taken a very cautious and careful approach to selecting only the best crews, providing the best training that we can deliver, and at whatever rate that goes is the rate we're going to grow. That's a little bit of a race. Can Vern produce airplanes faster than we can build operations? I don't know where that's going to play out over time. That's one of the things that's most interesting to me, to see, the yin and the yang of this thing as it evolves. Mm-hmm. There's no doubt in my mind that there's sufficient demand. It's very simple to add significant demand. For instance, if I add two more day ports, I'm only adding two day ports, but I'm more than doubling the number of connections in the core network.
Oh, yeah.
So, because you get the network effects starting now. So, as we add more day ports, the number of combinations, places people can go, and hence demand keeps growing. So, it's not a question of finding them. It's a question of serving it safely and reliably.
Well, Ed, we really appreciate your taking some time to talk to us today. You've got a fascinating thing going on, both from the aviation standpoint and from the operational standpoint. I think that, obviously, there have already been some other industries that have expressed an interest in this kind of capability from a software standpoint, and you've expressed before your intention to kind of keep things vertically integrated within your company. So we're going to have to just keep calling you, Ed, to see how this whole idea works out.
Okay. I'll be glad to talk to you. I enjoyed it.
My guest has been Ed Akabuchi, who is the President and Chief Executive Officer of DayJet Corporation. You can find out more about the company at www.dayjet.com. You've been listening to a special feature from Aero News. Find us on the web at www.aero.news.net. I'm Paul Plack. Thanks for listening. Have a clear and unlimited day.